I'm glad to see you all here. I'm not quite sure why you chose this classroom when you could have been next door at Mr. John's or any of the other ones. But welcome. My name is Jaden Salsbus, and I'm from locally here. I don't teach at this school. How many of you guys have taught less than 1 year? Okay, not very many. How many of you have, like, say, 3+? Okay, so like probably some of you guys should be up here instead of me. Anyway, I did agree to do this talk, and hopefully we can kind of learn together. Although I would kind of echo the words of John Smucker from this morning when he quoted the Apostle Paul, "I count not myself to have attained," but you know, we can all keep pressing forward, right? A little bit about me before we start. My last name is Stolzfus. That probably means Pennsylvania to a lot of you. I was born there. I did not live there very long. I grew up mostly in Tennessee and other places around the world. Did some years on the mission field and so forth. Moved out here 3 years ago or so and have been teaching since. My school is Pioneer Christian Academy, which is in Brownsville. It's a little east of here. So I don't teach at this school. None of my students go to church with me, which is a blessing and a curse, I suppose. But it is a Mennonite school-ish. We also have roughly 50% of our enrollment is community people. So not all of them go to church. We have a bunch of people from single-parent homes, from no-parent homes. So it's really kind of a very mixed bag there at school. But it's really the thing that brought me to Oregon, and it's one of the things that keeps me here. And the other thing that keeps me here is that my wife is from here. She's not here this morning, but Shayna used to be Eversole. So we have been married for a little more than a year, and that has been a blessing. Anyway, we're going to proceed with our talk this morning on motivation. I don't have any fancy handouts. This is the way I'm used to teaching. I have it on, yes. This is the way I'm used to teaching, so hopefully you can find ways to take notes and learn from this anyway. So, motivation. What does motivation mean to different people? How do we inspire motivation? Rowena's back here, has been teaching for 15 years, of course, in a very different level than I am, and some of you people over here as well, I'm sure, have been teaching for a decade or more. And like, you're here in this class. Why are you here?
Motivated to rest.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I've taught 3 years, and it hasn't gotten easier for me, I think, to figure out ways to keep students engaged and interested and wanting to move forward, because moving forward is work, right? And students don't like to work as a general thing. But let's back up here a little bit. Talk about some definitions. So the title of this talk here is Inspiring Motivation. Well, what does it mean to inspire? What does that word mean to y'all?
To create a desire from within.
Desire from within. Invitation towards, okay, yeah. There's a few different angles you could go with. One of the things I often think of when I think of inspiration, though, is having a life or having a vision, having energy within something or someone. So, energy to move towards or energy to accept something. But when I think of inspiration, it's something that is alive, right? Like we think of Ezekiel in the Valley of the Dry Bones. And those bones did not have inspiration until the Spirit of the Lord came upon them. And then that's a picture to me of what inspiration is. Something that has life of itself. It's not something that is being coaxed out of it, right? It's something that exists within whatever we're giving inspiration to. What does it mean then to motivate? How is this different than inspiration? So there's a little, so motivation has the thought of a little more of a, yeah, a push or a pull something. What else does motivation mean?
It's like you're self, I don't know, not governed, but self-motivated? Like they're being pushed through their own desire, like what they want to do.
Yeah. And so it's coming from within, but it's also responding to an external force, right? That's sort of what motivation means to me, is where we cause someone to choose something. So where inspiration is, we give life, or we give a vision. We want people to have it in themselves, right? But we want it within themselves to choose something. And so we're on the other side of the tightrope, if you will. And we say, you can do it. You can move this way. And that is what it means to me to motivate students, is that we bring them towards where we are. And we kind of find ways to put that within them, and where it's not all external, but where they kind of buy into it themselves. And that's not always easy. And there's a lot of different factors that play into different people's motivation levels. When I do other kinds of work, sometimes I catch myself thinking about what motivates me and why I'm doing this, right? And there's a lot of different reasons for people being motivated to do anything. There's a bunch of different factors, and I came up with a bunch, and I'm sure there's a bunch more, because humans are never one-sided, right? Humans always contain multitudes, and that holds true in so many different levels, but humans never do anything for only one reason. And so a child who is motivated to excel at school or who wants to learn new things rarely does it for only one reason. There's always a lot of different things going on. One of the things, maybe the predominant initial factor of motivation, is probably simply their nature, the thing that they're born with. And some of you guys teach kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and you see that there for sure, where a lot of these young kids are just naturally curious. They want to learn, they're motivated to learn their ABCs, and they want to learn to read and whatever else. And then by the time they get to 7th and 8th grade, which I think I didn't mention is what I teach, by the time they get to 7th and 8th grade, most of them have lost that initial curiosity, and a few of them still have some motivation to learn, but it might be blanketed by other things. Anyway, so their human nature is, to me, kind of the thing that gets them going in a lot of ways. And some children are just naturally more curious, and those are the kinds, often, that are easier to teach. But there's, of course, other factors at play as well. One of the other factors that comes in to children is home environment, and this kind of gets into the nature versus nurture debate, right? Does a child become the thing that he is because of nature or because of the way he was raised? And, you know, that's a whole philosophical discussion that nobody has figured out, right? And I have thoughts and stuff, but we're not going to get into all of that. The bottom line, though, is that nurture or your home environment plays a huge role in what a child, how much a child is motivated, what a child thinks about education. To some parents, education is important. They want to know what their children's grades are, so on and so forth. So there's an attitude toward education in the home. Then they also, some kids grow up around a lot of books. Some kids don't grow up around books. And to me, that's a huge difference in how much a child wants to learn, is just simply their exposure to good and appropriate reading material that stretches them, stuff that's, you know, available for them and is interesting to them, or that their parents move them towards, right? And so, if there's one thing that I could change about most of my parents at school, it is that they would get their kids to read more. I just think that's a huge deal for kids learning to enjoy school is learning to read. It just opens their mind, it makes them curious, I think. So things like that. And then of course in the home environment, I have kids at school who go home and they're on a screen the rest of the day. It's the only thing they do the rest of the day. That's the kind of thing also that doesn't produce, you know, motivated kids. Probably most of your kids are not that way. I don't know. But regardless, do they go home and are they taught responsibility? Do they have chores? Or do they just go home and goof off the rest of the day? Things like that make a huge difference in how disciplined and motivated they are. And there's also things like their parents, talked about this a little bit already. But specifically, the parents' engagement in their child's schooling experience. And this is not a thing that we can change, although we are given the opportunities to build relationships with our parents, with our school children's parents. And that's, I think, very vital, is if we can involve the parents in the school as much as possible, give them some ownership of their child's education, and that kind of thing can go a long ways towards motivating children. Because if a child feels like the school is his thing and his parents are completely out of it, it's a little difficult for the child to take ownership of something that his parents don't support, right? It's the nature of a child. So that's a big deal. Other things, their health. This includes their physical health. I have kids who drink a Red Bull in the morning, go home and probably don't drink much water the rest of the day. You know, things like that. And kids who come to school without breakfast. Kids who, you know, why not get a solid meal, just eat snacks all day. Things like that. That's hugely detrimental, as I'm sure you all know. So physical health, again, not really a thing we can change, but hopefully maybe a thing we can encourage, right? Spiritual health, mental health, all factors that play into motivation here. And things that I think, even though we can't change, we do well to consider and try to encourage our kids to take care of themselves and understand that their bodies have a huge influence on, well, their future, ultimately. Other things like past experience. Kids who've had good teachers in the past, kids who've, you know, excelled in school or have been encouraged by people in ways that help them excel, things like that. Again, completely out of our control. But understanding what a child has experienced in the past, I think, can help us understand how to reach them in the future. Their peers, the people that they're around. Of course, for different ages, this means different things. But for a lot of young children, well, school is fun and all their peers are into it and it's great fun. And then, as I mentioned before, by the time they get to seventh grade, school isn't cool anymore. And so you have that whole thing to deal with. And it's one of those things you just kind of have to accept. And you can, again, encourage kids to think positively. But if all their classmates talk about is how, you know, at the end of the school year, they're going to take their school books home and riddle them with bullet holes and so on and so forth, that is not an attitude, I don't think, that's conducive towards motivating a kid to do well. And again, with their peers, just general attitudes of respect and honoring others, things like that, have a huge influence in their overall levels of motivation, their life goals. I have a student, actually, she has moved into high school now, but I have a student who is not particularly adept at school. She doesn't read the best, she doesn't have the best hand-eye coordination, she has a great memory, and she's very lively. But she probably wouldn't do as well as she does at school if she didn't have a lifelong dream, I don't know when this started, but years before I was in the picture, of becoming a vet. She just really wants to become a vet. And I think Rowena knows who I'm talking about here. And she is quite a fireball. And I have really appreciated the way that her desire to become a vet motivates her to do things that she otherwise does not want to do, has no interest in, does not see the point for, and she will tell you that that is the way she feels. But regardless of how she feels, she does it anyway because she understands, at some level at least, that this is a stepping stone toward her dream of becoming a vet. And so if we can sort of tap into those life goals and sort of understand what a kid sees itself as in the future, and maybe even help them to think that way and help them to understand that their future is contingent on what they do today, that goes a long way. Things like curriculum. A lot of us probably have, you know, set curriculum for us. I appreciate my curriculum. We teach mostly at Becca, and I like it. There's probably things I would change about it. But regardless, there's no perfect curriculum, right? And so different kinds of curriculum motivate students in different ways. But maybe the most important factor in a child's motivation at school, last but not least, is a teacher. Probably all of you have had teachers in your past experience who've motivated you in different ways. And like all these other things play into it, right? Especially parents and home and your just your nature, things like that. But the teacher has immense influence, especially while a child is at school. We can't really control what a child feels or thinks or does at home or at church or with their friends. But we can, to some level, control while they're at school. And if we can at least change a child's perception of school while he is there and make school a place where when he comes, he sort of, you know, kind of buys into this thing, regardless of what he feels when he's at home, that goes a long way. And that's largely up to us as teachers. And so let's talk about teaching. What is teaching? Birch, what is teaching?
Giving information or helping somebody else to know something or how to do something.
Okay, so information or skills that we're passing on to others. Other definitions of teaching.
Drawing out knowledge.
Yeah, so exciting or drawing out things that maybe are within them and teaching them how to connect the dots. You know, that's interesting that you say that, but training is an important part of teaching. I talked to a teacher here a couple months ago, a man who I think did a pretty good job in the classroom, at least that's my perception, and I asked him why he stopped teaching, and he said, you know, I signed up to teach. I didn't sign up to manage a classroom and to train kids. It's not what I signed up for. And I'm like, wait a minute. You cannot teach without managing a class. You can't do it, right? They're intertwined. You cannot only teach. You will always also be training, so thanks for that. I think it is fundamental within teaching that we are also training kids and trying to make them into better versions of themselves. Different things like that, but one of the definitions that I like about teaching is the cause to learn. So it's not only a one-way transfer of information, right? I'm not only standing here and giving information to you. There's also an active participation by the learner. And so my job as a teacher, your job as teachers, is to cause a child to learn out of his own resources, essentially. And so we can stand up here and we can try to hit people over the head with a sledgehammer. Doesn't work very well until they want to learn. And so to cause someone to learn, to bring them to a point where they understand that this is information they need, that's how I think teaching ultimately happens. It's a two-way street. Both people have to be involved here. And there's a lot of different things that fall into teaching. Teaching means a lot of different things, but it is imparting knowledge, ultimately. Is as far as the academic side of things go. It's knowledge that I possess or should possess that I'm trying to impart, inculcate into my children and that I want them to be able to use and to hopefully learn new things with that information. And there's a bunch of different, I guess, angles to look at teaching. One book that probably a bunch of you have read is John Milton Gregory's Seven Laws of Teaching. I'm sure anyone who has taught for very long or gone through any kind of like beginner teacher course has been recommended that book. But a bunch of his laws are, I think, still very helpful for me to think about. Things like the law of common language. We all talk English, right? That's not what Gregory's talking about. It's more the law that unless your students are able to communicate with you, not just in English, but through like their mental ideas and just the way they process information, learning doesn't really happen. Things like the law of teaching says that teaching does not happen unless you excite the self activities of the learner, where the learner has to be doing work, otherwise teaching isn't happening. And then the law of the lesson, where new information, new truths have to be built on things that they already possess, on old truths. We cannot effectively teach someone their multiplication tables unless they understand the numbers right. That's just obvious. And of course, there's a lot of less obvious examples where new information always has to build on old information. So all those different things are part of teaching. And unless we really understand some of those fundamentals, we are not going to talk to our students effectively. And if we cannot communicate with our students, I don't think there's going to be much motivation in the classroom. Because unless the student feels understood, and unless he feels like he can understand the teacher, that kind of a fundamental disconnect, I think, is extremely harmful. But maybe Gregory's most important law as far as motivation goes is that the teacher must know. Somebody fill in the blank here. Somebody knows this law. That which he is to teach. So yes, the teacher must know that which he is to teach. Because you cannot effectively teach someone something that you don't know. I had a teacher in 7th grade, I believe, who was a well-intentioned man, but he was a busy man. He was a pastor, a family, all those things. And in many cases, I felt like I knew more about the lesson than he did. And I still learned, I suppose, right, because I was in school, but I don't think I learned nearly as much as I could have if the teacher had actually known that which he was to teach, because you cannot effectively teach someone history unless you have probably done a lot more studying than the children will have to do. Ultimately, you have to know more than you expect your kids to know, otherwise you cannot bring them anywhere close to where you feel like they know what they need to know. And so things like just studying into, if you're teaching about the Revolutionary War, just studying the Revolutionary War, or if you're, you know, teaching basic algebra, just studying a little more advanced algebra, whatever it is, I think having like knowledge above and beyond that which you need to know is extremely helpful, because kids will ask you questions. And sometimes they're good questions, sometimes they're not. But all questions deserve to be answered, right? And just having more knowledge than what your students are required is, I think, goes a long way towards motivating children. If they see that, well, you actually know quite a bit about the subject at hand, then they feel like they have something to learn, hopefully. A teacher also, of course, is required, I think, to have a certain level of enthusiasm. Now, this comes more naturally to some people than to others, right? Some people are a little, I don't know, a little humdrum, maybe? And that works fine for some people, right? But for most students, I think, and most teachers, a certain level of liveliness and enthusiasm is important. If you can't vary your facial expressions, if you cannot vary your tone and your speed of talking, things like that, if you're not excited about your content, I don't think learning happens as effectively as it otherwise would. If people don't feel like you care at all about the grammar that you're teaching them this morning, they're probably not going to care very much either. Things like that. It's just extremely important to at least pretend to be enthusiastic about what you're teaching, because let's face it, sometimes we teach lessons that we just don't understand why this is important. We don't understand how we're supposed to teach it effectively. Don't understand what this has to do with anything. But we can still at least pretend to be excited, right? Because faking it till you make it is probably a bigger part of teaching school than most people realize, right? You can always fake happiness. At least do that. Like, I know of teachers who, their children said they never smiled all year long. Like, I find that a little hard to believe, but like, that's a terrible reputation, right? You can at least pretend to be happy, pretend like you want to be there. Sometimes you even have to pretend to love them. And that's important. Faking it until you make it. So a certain level of enthusiasm. Talking about love, though, maybe love is the most important factor in a teacher's ability to motivate his students. You've probably all heard the saying that a student doesn't care how much you know until he knows how much you care. A student doesn't care how much you know until he knows how much you care. I think there's a lot of truth to that. A person a month or two ago asked me, and I don't know why he asked me this, because as I said, I don't consider myself some fountain of knowledge, but he asked me what my greatest tip is for teaching. And I thought about it a little bit. I said, just let your kids know you love them. It doesn't always come easy, because sometimes it's not a thing we're feeling. But just telling your kids that you love and appreciate them for who they are and not for what they do, that goes a long way towards building a relationship, first and foremost. But also, it helps a lot in getting your kids to a place where they want to learn and where they want to know the things that you have to teach them. Tell your kids you love them. Just tell them. They're going to act like it's dumb and you don't mean it and they're unlovable and whatever. Tell them anyway. And you know, mean it. Hopefully, mean it. Now, as you probably all know, love is a lot of different things. I asked my kids to define love one time. We were going through 1 John. 1 John talks a lot about love. I had them define love, and they came up with a lot of different things. And most of them gave the thought that love is a feeling of affection or some kind of, you know, warm and fuzzy, or, you know, attraction, something like that. You know, love can be that, but most days my level of affection for my students is not the highest. But that's not the only thing that love is, right? Love means commitment. We heard about that this morning. Love means service and sacrifice. Love means that you show up and you do your best, even when your kids aren't doing their best, because it's easy for us as teachers to be like, yeah, your kids aren't even trying. Why should I bother trying? No, that's not love, right? Love is you keep giving it 110%, even if your kids are giving it 65%. That, and even though your kids maybe don't recognize it, I think there's still something within them that, you know, responds to that. So, different things about love. It's a choice, not a feeling. It's the first commandment. Jesus said, it's the first commandment. Everything else comes after. And I think that's also true in school, where if we don't understand our students and try to get to know them, try to plug into what their interests are and what, you know, what they ultimately want out of life, I don't think we can do well at teaching them. Maybe moving into the more practical side, though, I have 15 minutes here, it looks like, so I might have to keep moving. There's two kinds of motivation. Probably we've all heard this, or at least if we've been around teaching very long. Two kinds of motivation, extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. Fairly self-explanatory definitions to these, right? But I think it's important to recognize that these two kinds of motivation are always present in every person to some level. Some people have more, require more of one or the other, but these things always work together and they're always both present. And so we have to understand how to maybe relate to these and manage them. So extrinsic motivation simply refers, at least to me, as doing something for reward or punishment. So we do something for reward or punishment. This etching here over here in the corner, it looks like something out of a Dickens novel, or I'm not sure. And hopefully we don't ever resort to this kind of corporal punishment. But doing something for reward or punishment is extrinsic motivation. And it can work, right? We probably all do things for reward, subconsciously or consciously. In fact, I was talking to you about my student who has a desire to go to vet school, right? She wants to become a vet. That in itself is a kind of extrinsic motivation where she doesn't want to do the things that she's doing because she likes them. She does them, so they help her get to vet school. Whatever else. So doing things for reward or punishment, that's extrinsic. And then intrinsic motivation is doing something for its own sake or for personal interest. So doing something for its own sake or personal interest. So extrinsic and intrinsic. Some people just like to learn. Some people like to read, they like to study, they like to know things, they like to be able to engage with a topic. That's what I would consider as intrinsic motivation. Some people like math, some people like grammar, some people like science. And so different students are going to have different levels of intrinsic motivation on a given day, on a given subject, whatever it is. And that's not always the thing that we can change, but hopefully it's a thing that we can at least influence. I don't know what you all think about extrinsic motivation and your role as a teacher in providing extrinsic motivation, but personally, I try to kind of stay away from it. I was told by Patrick Heatwall, a man that I respect greatly, to, like, you just don't have to do any extrinsic motivation. Like, sure, some is good, but they also provide that for themselves to a certain level. And even, you know, things like grades. Grades are an extrinsic motivator that can produce intrinsic motivation, hopefully. So extrinsic things can become intrinsic if the student wants them to be. You know, grades mean different things to different people. But some of my students, we have literature class, and I'm trying to get them to read poetry. I will often, you know, pick a student, I'll have them read a stanza, and then I give them a grade on their reading, and I try to not give them hundreds, right? And so, like, you wouldn't think they would buy into that, but they do. They love it so much when you know, little miss over here, she reads something, and I give her an 84, and then the boy across from her, he reads, and he gets a 91, and then we can kind of go down the row, and they try and try and try, and, like, that has been pretty effective for me in teaching students to read expressively, to look at punctuation, like just basic things, right? But grades can be a huge deal if you find ways to implement them well. They don't always work to people, for everyone. Some people are going to be, I'm just going to get an 85, may as well get a 75, what's the difference, right? And so, like, you're going to have some of that. But still finding ways to use extrinsic motivators to produce intrinsic motivation, I think, is something that can be helpful. But extrinsic rewards especially, punishment is its own subject, but rewards especially are something that I'm hesitant to use for a number of reasons. And again, I don't feel like I have a lot of knowledge here. Most of you have taught longer than I have, I think. And so maybe you have different opinions, and you're welcome to that. But I think for most people, rewards produce mostly excitement about the prize instead of the challenge. And if all I'm doing is going through school so that I can get whatever prize when I get 100 on a test or whatever, that's not really an excitement for learning. That's an excitement for the prize. And conflating the two is easy to do, where we say, "Ha, the kids are excited about getting a good grade." That's good, but we want them to actually want to learn the material, right? They need to be more than just excited about a reward or a prize. They need to actually want to learn the material, because if you simply learn just enough to get the prize, well, now we've created a bargaining mentality in the children. And bargaining mentality goes in a lot of different directions, right? But one of the things that it does is where a lot of students will do just enough to get the prize, right? If we say, well, the prize is for getting a 95 or better, they don't really care then if they get 100 anymore. They just care if they get the prize. Or where now everything that they do, they want to be rewarded for. It's like, what's in it for me? You want them to do an assignment or an art project or whatever it is. Art is horrible for me. I don't know how about it for all of you. I hate art so much. I wish somebody would come and just take all my art classes. But you know, you gotta fake it, right? But one of the problems that I have in art is that the kids, and this is probably my own fault, because I have given them in the past rewards and things for doing their art projects well. And so now every time we do an art project that's any kind of complicated, it's like, what's in it for me? What's the prize? You know, that whole bargaining mentality is just the thing that's bound to happen if you simply reward them just to get them to do things that they should just be expected to do, things that are just basic. Another thing that happens too is where they want to know what happens if I don't do the assignment correctly. They say, well, if I just don't try, then what happens? Well, that's a question you cannot answer. Because if you tell them, oh, well, you just get a bad grade, then they get to decide if they want to have the bad grade and live with it, or if they actually want to do well. And giving them that choice is something that you should not do. I read a book over the summer called With All Due Respect by Ronald Moorish, and he goes into this in a lot more detail. But we cannot give students a choice between a consequence versus doing something right. Where don't say, you know, the next time you talk in class, I'm gonna yada, yada, yada. Because now they can make the choice between accepting the punishment and acting the way they want, or actually doing the right thing. And that's not a choice that you should be giving them. So if they ask, what happens if I don't do this? Well, you know, you find other ways to say, well, you'll find out then, or we'll deal with it then, or you don't want to know what's going to happen, right? So you don't give them that choice. You expect them to do it right. And so when you use a lot of rewards, you wind up with those kinds of bargains. What's in it for me, or what happens if I just don't? Rewards also just bring temporary change, for the most part, I think. Now, they can build habits. Habits, of course, are extremely important. We can use rewards for 100% on quizzes or whatever to create a habit of study. I think that can be effective for some people. But in many cases, I think extrinsic motivators, extrinsic rewards, mostly just bring temporary change. They'll study well just long enough to achieve whatever it is they're trying to achieve. And then after that, they're back to square one. Rewards also kind of change the definition of success. What I mean by that is that success to me in school is that you have learned to learn. You have learned to apply yourself. You have learned to absorb new material, to do your best, you know, you don't feel like it. That to me is the definition of success, is when you have, you know, actively put yourself into the work and grown through it. Whereas when you offer a lot of rewards to children for things that they should just be doing regardless of reward or punishment, now the definition of success is, did I get the candy bar? Or, you know, did I get the trip to McDonald's? Whatever it is. So things like that, where the definition of success is no longer actually learning, it's something completely unrelated to school. And so I don't consider that particularly helpful. Rewards, of course, also create additional work and expense for the teachers. And I think all teachers, to a certain extent, are probably, you know, overworked and underpaid, where there's always more things that you can, you know, put your energy into, and more work that can be done. And I think trying to focus on a lot of extrinsic motivation just really adds a lot of work for the teacher and expense. I can't afford to buy my kids, you know, a $20 doodad for getting a good test grade, whatever it is. Like, it's not feasible long term. And, you know, teaching does probably require a certain amount of expenditure, and I don't think we should be afraid of that. But I don't think we should build it into our classroom where we say, in order to get my kids to perform, I'm going to buy them all kinds of things. It might work for some people. I don't know. It doesn't work for me. So then, let's talk about intrinsic motivation. If extrinsic motivation isn't working, well, then we need to somehow tap into their intrinsic motivation. And I think that kind of starts with expectations in a few different ways. One is your expectations of their general behavior. If you don't know how you want them to behave, well, they're probably not going to behave the way you want them to behave. So you need to have routines. You need to have, like, planned out ways that you're going to do things, and planned out ways that happen, things that happen when they don't do what you want them to do. You've got to have routines. You've got to have schedules. You've got to have procedures for things that don't matter. How they hand in their test papers, or how they file in and out of the room for lunch, whatever it is. You've got to think through these things, because these expectations produce stability in the school, and they also give you now a foundation for their expectations of learning. And if you don't expect them to learn, they're not going to learn, trust me. I mean, probably some of them will. But if you don't expect them to learn what you're trying to teach them, it's not going to work well. And so high expectations. I don't know if you can have expectations too high or not. I suppose you probably can. But kids tend to live up to their expectations more or less. And so it's not a thing that's always easy for me. I tend to be a little cynical, skeptical. I prefer the term realist, but you know. And so positive expectations are not always easy for me. But I think it is very valuable to just expect a lot out of your kids. And then, you know, if they don't quite meet it, well, then you can take that how you wish. You can deal with it or not. But at least try to raise your expectations to more than you think the kids can do. Hopefully they come that way. Then, of course, you also have to encourage them. So expectations, encouragement. We are not somebody who stands at the top of the stairs and reaches down and pulls them up, right? That's not our job. We're supposed to walk up the stairs with them, clap for them, and encourage them to get up the stairs, because it's our work. But I think that's our job. And just recognizing that they're doing hard work, I think, can go a long way for students, because sometimes stuff looks easy to us, right? How hard is it to add 2 and 2 or 9 and 6, whatever? But for some kids, that's really hard. And so if we can recognize that it's hard for them and say, I understand, this is tough, but look, like, you can do it. I know you can do it. It'll be easier tomorrow. You know, just positive encouragement instead of, oh, whatever, it's fine, just do it. Like, that kind of a write-off attitude does not produce motivation. Engagement in your lessons. So this means something like having a decent lesson plan. Now, I don't ever, I think, go through the whole 5-step lesson plan or whatever it is. Some people do. That works. It's great for them. But at least try to have a good structure for your lesson. When I teach specifically science and history, I almost always teach this way off of a PowerPoint. I don't do it so often for math and language, things like that. But at least try to, for sure, understand your content. Try to find creative examples. Kids love to be in their work. Like, if you can come up with math problems that have their names in them, come up with grammar sentences that are about things they're doing, they love that. So find ways to make lessons and assignments engaging and exciting for them. And of course, just work on your teaching style. Things like saying, I've been doing that this morning, I know. That's not good speaking, right? Things that you can work on. Things like when you're at the board, don't turn your back to them all the time. You've got to keep your eyes on your kids. And again, be aware of your inflection, your volume, the speed at which you speak. I tend to talk very fast. And works fine for some people. Some people get lost in weeds. And so, yeah, that's the thing that I kind of have to work on. And things like that. So work on your teaching. Try to keep it engaging. And then recognition, I think, is also important in motivation. Now, recognition to me is not the same thing as reward. Reward is where I give you something because you've done your assignment well. Where recognition is more that I recognize, I affirm, that you've done a good job. It's kind of the same thing as coming along beside your child and saying, I understand that this is hard. I see that this is not easy for you. It'll get better tomorrow, right? We recognize that they've done a good job. Just writing good job on a paper goes a long way. I often write fantastic or excellent when they get 100%. And then kids want to know, why do you write fantastic sometimes and excellent the other times? Like, they pay attention to these things. It matters. Or just, like, some teachers use, you know, stickers or whatever. You might teach 8th, 9th, 10th grade and you think, they're past that. I don't think they are. They care about this kind of affirmation. Even the boys who are farmers, don't want to be at school, don't care about, they would tell you at least, they don't care about the grades. They still care about having their good work affirmed. And so if you can at least point out, you know, things that they did well, things that they are succeeding in, extremely helpful. And ultimately, building a welcoming environment for our kids is extremely important, I think. If we have a classroom that's, you know, decorated nicely, orderly, and where the teacher is smiling, mean it or not, smile, and whatever else it is that we can do to make our classrooms a welcoming environment, a safe space to learn, a place where they understand what's going to happen, they understand what's expected of them, and they understand how to do it. Because if you don't understand what's expected and how to do it, now you're just groping, and that does not produce motivation or results in students. So different things like that. We're out of time. I haven't got quite through all my material, but that's okay. Any other questions, comments, thoughts?
You were talking about literature and reading poetry in the spring. Is that a verbal grade?
Yeah.
Right on the spot?
Yeah, yeah. Right on the spot. Mm-hmm. They will read 4 lines and I give them a grade. Okay, well, thank you for your attention. Thank you for coming. Hopefully, even if you didn't learn a lot, hopefully at least I gave you things you can think about and things you can explore for yourself. So, I guess you're dismissed.